Okay, good. So let's just review a little bit from last week. So last week we talked about the apple. This is working this week. Look at that. We got a new one. We said the apple is tapuach. It's a symbol of the soul, like the same word as limpoach, to blow. God blew the neshama into our nostrils. That's what we remember Rosh Hashanah, because Rosh Hashanah we connect to the soul. Also, we talked about the idea that the apple has the name of Hashem. I forgot to mention, because someone asked me afterwards, it actually has to do with gematria, because the name of God is Yud, and Hey and Vav and Hey, which Yud is 10, Hey is 5, Vav is 6, and Hey is 5. That's why you have the 5 pits, the 5 spaces, the 10 dots, and then the stem that looks like a Vav. Okay. So, then we talk about the pomegranate, being the idea that same word as maron, which means single file. God looks at us individually, but at the same time, we're united. He looks at us also with abundance, so we've got many mitzvot. And that's why the rimon, the pomegranate, is sort of a antidote to that. Okay. As we explained last week. And there's a things here if you want. And? Okay. All right. So today, I want to look at two of the other simanim. Not yet. Okay. Two of the other simanim. And that is, actually not two of the other simanim, one other siman, but it's got two concepts. That's what I meant. There's a concept, there's a custom many people have. Some people find it hard to stomach, but there is a custom that people have on their Rosh Hashanah table, a siman that is mentioned in the early sources, the head of a fish. Right? Yes. Now, I just want to point out something, which maybe is relevant particularly to the head of the fish. There is a concept brought in the sources when it discusses the simanim. Let's say, for example, even the apple. Let's say someone's allergic to apples or whatever. They can't eat apples, right? There's actually still a concept of having them on the table. Because in some sources, it doesn't actually say you have to eat the simanim, although that's the custom, the prevailing custom. But there's a concept just to have them as codes on the table. So if you don't like eating fish from the fish head, some people love it, by the way. My mother used to love it, sure. When she came here for Rosh Hashanah, I remember as a kid, but I remember when she came here for Rosh Hashanah, we used to all like take a little piece and then give it to her and she would polish it off. Like, not all, the parts that you can eat. I mean, if it's a meaty head, you know, you've got to have a good one. Anyway. There's the thing I say. Right? So there is such a concept of not always people can eat it, so therefore if you can't eat it for whatever reason, health reasons, whatever the reason, or you just can't stomach eating fish off a fish head, then it's also something it's a good thing just to have it on the table. Okay. So what I want to share with you actually is just to break it down this custom, first of all for general knowledge and to Just to break it down, the head of a fish is actually a combination of two customs, two different simanim. One idea is to eat a head of an animal. It can be any animal for that matter, right? Wait, you haven't heard anything yet? It gets worse. And the other is to eat fish. Combine fish head. Now, why do I say it gets worse? Because there actually is a custom, which was very prevalent in Europe. There's still some people that do it today. You ready? To have a head of a ram on the table. Yeah. I had a great uncle, he would do that.
That must be huge.
Quite huge, or head of a, or not, if head of a head of a lamb, maybe. And the real, so, well, I hope it's dead. No, it's dead for sure. Yeah. No, it would be cooked. No, so there is a way. You see, that's the problem. It's very difficult to get today because actually you have to know how to kasher it. It's not so simple. Which is why people don't do it today a lot. But in the times when people would check their own animals in their back farm and something like that, or go to the town shochet and then prepare the rest themselves, it would happen. The reason for the head of a ram, now we're going to talk about the reason of a head in a minute. But let's just talk about something else first, which is why they used to have the head of a ram is to remember the Akedah. Akedat Yitzchak, the binding of Yitzchak. Basically, just in case, you know, just to clarify the story, Hashem tells Avram, he tests him to sacrifice only his son on the altar. He takes him to Yerushalayim, the Temple Mount. Last minute, God says, take him off. And then Avram realizes there's a ram in the thicket of the bush, and he brings the ram as a substitute sacrifice instead of Yitzchak. It's called the Eloi Shel Yitzchak, the ram of Yitzchak, which, by the way, has to do with the whole shofar thing as well. It's one of the many reasons given for shofar. To remember the Akedah, shofar typically doesn't have to come from a ram, but typically it does. It's a ram's horn. And there's generally a theme throughout Rosh Hashanah, we remember the Akedah, right? In fact, in the Musaf, in the second part of the davening of Rosh Hashanah, we have three special blessings. One's called remembrance, the middle one, and it ends off by asking God to remember the Akedah. What's the idea? I wanted to just go into it for a few minutes because it's important to understand why we do that. So the one is just about merit. We remember the merits of our forefathers, and particularly the Akedah, because when God asked Avraham to go and sacrifice Yitzchak on the altar, which was a test, of course, right? What we say to God on Rosh Hashanah is, look, Avraham we know was a man of compassion, a man of kindness. For him to be ready to do that, he actually had to squash his character. He had to really bury his kindness and expose the discipline, I guess, right? Just to do the word of God, right? So we ask God to do the reverse, to do a similar thing. That it's possible that he comes to Yom HaDin, he comes to the Day of Judgment. Maybe he's angry with us. Maybe he's not so happy with us, right? Maybe we're not so deserving. Of course, we believe we are, but hopefully God will look at us with compassion. But we do this through the prayer, that we know we're not perfect. We know we haven't always done the right thing. But we ask God to do what Abraham did just in the reverse, to squash his emotion of judgment, his character of judgment, which he is in the time of Rosh Hashanah, and to substitute that with rachamim, with mercy. That's one of the big themes of Rosh Hashanah, as we spoke about last week. That's one idea. The second idea of always remembering the Akedah is, I think, is also an unbelievable foundation of how to start the new year. And as I've said many times, this, I think, is so relevant nowadays, in this time that we live in. And that's to strengthen emunah. One of the greatest things about the Akedah is Avraham's emunah. What I mean by that? Faith, yeah. But you know, we spoke about it recently. Faith, by definition, is irrational. That's what faith is. Faith is that you don't understand and you still believe, right? Now, in Avraham's case, this is a small, lesser-known background, right? The Akedah comes following the promise from God to Avraham that he will have children through Yitzchak. Right, he blessed him with a son. He had Yitzchak. He promised him to make him a nation. The nation will get Eretz Israel, the land of Israel. There will be as many as the stars and the dust of the sea. All the different promises that God had given. And Yitzchak was not married, and God had yet, and God had promised Abraham, ki be Yitzchak yikarei lecha zara. It will be through Yitzchak that you will have children. That's going to be the line, the lineage of the Jewish nation, through Yitzchak. And then, so all of a sudden, God appears to Avraham and says, go and take your son, your only son, as he called him, right, Bincha Yechidcha, and offer him on the Mizbeach as a sacrifice, which would make the promise of God impossible. And that's Emunah. And Avraham says, you say, I do. Okay, later on he understood how it was supposed to happen, but he didn't understand it at the time, right? And that's the foundation of Emunah. I mention this with tremendous emphasis because when I grew up as a young child, one of the many things, but one of the main things that my father would drill into us is this concept of Emunah, right? And he would always say this. I remember it so clearly. He would so often, he would say, you know what Emunah means? Emunah means that God tells, it didn't have to be the parasha of the Akedah or Rosh Hashanah, anything, any time of the year. He would say, Emunah means that God tells Avram that he'll have children through Yitzchak, and then he tells him to take him to the Akedah. That's Emunah. This was like embedded in my brain since I was a young child, right? Because that is Emunah. And therefore, I think we go into a new year every day, but particularly we go into a new year, living in a time where the world is not making sense, unfortunately, up until this morning.
Yeah.
I don't normally talk about news items, but I think we should acknowledge a friend of Israel, Charlie Kirk. He was... I don't know if he was a perfect human being, but he was certainly a friend of Israel. And it's a crazy world. So we have to start the year knowing that the year is a fresh beginning. And we have to go in with emunah that it's going to be okay. We have to believe God knows what He's doing. He's running the world. He's got a plan. And it will be good and things will work out. Collectively and in our own personal lives as well. Everyone has challenges. We have to strengthen. That's one of the big things of Rosh Hashanah. That's with things of the shofar, crying out to Hashem, talking to Hashem. It's one of the big things to strengthen our emunah. And the other part of Akedah, the other lesson is, going into the new year, it's also a time of growth. That's how we start a new year. Growth is something we always have to do, but particularly around Rosh Hashanah. Right? Coming into the new year, we need to reflect and see, maybe we can choose an area of our life that we can grow in, right? Socially, in relationships, spiritually, godly, whatever the areas are of our growth. And as we said so many times, but it's so related to the Akedah, that growth, the sign of real growth, is when you do something, not something you're comfortable with that you do more, which is also good, something you're not comfortable with and you do it. That's real growth. Where you make room within yourself to go beyond your comfort zone. And that, in fact, is one of the great lessons from the Akedah. Because what's interesting is that God calls to Abraham through an angel at the end of the Akedah, the end of the passage. By the way, you read about the Akedah, the second day of Yontif, right? So God calls to him and he said, you passed the test of flying colors. This was the 10th test that Abraham had received from God. You passed the flying colors. And then God says a very interesting thing. He says, Atai Yadaiti. Now I know that you're a God-fearing person. Now I know you're a good Jew. So all the commentaries ask, what do you mean? Like, he just passed 9 tests. 9 out of 10 is not a bad mark. It's not perfect, maybe, but it's pretty good, right? So what do you mean, now I know? We know from the first test. And the answer everyone gives is the following, that the first 9 tests were hard. It was hard work. But they didn't go in direct opposition with Abraham's character. Where Akedah did. Akedah, he had to actually really bend himself to do something that was completely beyond his nature, completely beyond his character.
Wasn't it a test for Isaac?
It was, and yet we always call it the test of Abraham. It's interesting, right?
Because he was a grown man.
He was 37. Could have run away. Yeah, he did. Right, it is a test, but it wasn't a direct test. It is all a test. The commentaries talk about that. In fact, I once saw a beautiful idea. It's not really relevant to the discussion now, but I'll just share quickly that when we believe in Torah, we know the Torah has two parts to it, the written Torah and the oral Torah, right? And we are supposed to believe in both. They're both divine and they both have a divine origin. But the one sometimes is harder to believe in than the other, because Torah Shebichtav is the word of God written down, right? Oral Torah is the interpretation from the great sages and so on. So I once saw a concept that one of the ideas of the Akedah is that for Abraham it was the written Torah and for Yitzchak it was the oral Torah, right? Abraham heard it straight from God, so that's the written Torah. Yitzchak heard it from the rabbi and the Gemara. He heard it from Abraham, and therefore him was the oral Torah. So it certainly was, yes, one of his merits too. But the idea of taking your own son is even worse. In other words, that's what some of the commentaries say. Of sacrificing your own son is worse than sacrificing yourself. Okay. So that's the third lesson from the Akedah. So the one is just remembering the merit of Abraham, asking God to remember that and to do the same for us in the reverse. Second is emunah, and the third is growth. Which involves real growth, revolves actually doing something that's a bit more out of our comfort zone. Which I always mention because it's not something that people find very easy to do today, especially the younger generation. But we have to do it. That's what real growth. Okay. Going back to the fish head, however, so that's if you game enough where you can find a ram's head, which I don't think anyone is. I once had some way maybe of possibly doing it, but as soon as I mentioned it at home, it was strongly vetoed. It was like either the people in the house or the ram, one of the two.
Is the only reason then that you can do the fish is because it can be little and sit on the table and not be
it looks fun. Some people find it hard, but the truth is, I think it's because people have always done it. So, you know, our parents did it, their parents did it. Most people always took a fish head, so we get used to it. I mean, I don't find a particularly problem, but I'm saying some people do, but okay. I mean, some of my kids always found it a problem. So, you know, one of the lessons, you do something that's uncomfortable, so you put it there, and after Kiddush or after washing, we took it away. But I mean, it should be there when the fish comes. Okay. So, it's a whole tradition now. My wife goes to the fish market. she buys one for us, for my daughter, for my son. It's like she's the provider of the fish heads. Okay. Cooks them. It's a whole story. It's a whole way to cook a fish head. I don't know what it is. It's not my area of expertise, but it is. Anyway. Okay, but let's talk about the idea. So that's the idea of have a ram's head, the akedah. But if it's a fish, but there is a concept, if you don't have the ram, of eating a fish, a head of an animal, or having a head of an animal on the table, and that's the fish. Now, why is there an idea of having a head? What is the concept? The head of the year. But, you know, if you look in the art scroll, Siddur particularly, you'll see that any one of the simanim, if people eat them, there's a tefillah, there's a little short prayer you say with it. And the prayer with eating the fish head, in terms of the head part of it, it says that we pray to God, she l'rosh v'lo l'zanav. We should be like a head and not like a tail. Okay. So what do you think that means? What? Sorry? A leader or a follower. Yeah. So we're asking about ourselves. So we should be heads. So we should all be leaders.
Well, we should be an example.
Okay, it's getting closer. So I saw a nice idea. In fact, Rabbi Musk quoted an article, I think, a few years ago, about what does it mean to be a head and what does it mean to have proper leadership, right? So everyone's a leader, first of all. But the problem is that we know in the world, we see this often, we see a lot with politicians, with other leaders, that the leaders are not really leaders, right? In other words, leadership requires a certain strength. All leadership. Leadership requires a certain strength and vision and discipline and a strength to lead rather than follow, right? So, you know, it's an interesting little thing. So, in a couple of weeks ago, there was in the Parsha, the mitzvah of appointing a king, right? When the Jews used to come in. And by extension, it's the mitzvah of appointing general leadership. And we know, and there's a famous piece from the Kli Yakar. Those not a Kli Yakar was a rabbi, Shlomo Ephraim Luntzich, I think his name was. He was a disciple of the Maharal. He's buried in Prague, not far from the Maharal. I was actually at his gravesite a year ago, when I was in Prague. It's very beautiful to be there. But he was very, very famous. He was a great tzaddik, and he wrote a beautiful commentary on the Chumash. And he asks a question that many commentaries ask. That is like this: we find in the Torah and Shoftim that we should, when the Jews get to Israel, they should appoint a king, right? Melech, a melech, like David a melech, and so on. However, and that's actually part of three mitzvot. Ultimately, when the Jews entered the land of Israel, there was three mitzvot they had to fulfill: appoint a king, destroy the nation of Amalek, because they attacked the Jewish people, and then to build a Beit HaMikdash. Okay. So eventually, after they'd settled the land, there was the king Saul, Shaul. He fought a war against Amalek. Actually didn't finish the job. He left the king alive. As a result, Haman came, and then we had the story of Purim, and he was criticized for it. I always feel that, you know, it was a good thing at the end of the day, because we have Purim, otherwise we wouldn't have Purim. Okay, but anyway, and then they built, and then afterwards, the King David, when he became the king, he laid the plans for the temple, and then his son Shlomo Melech built the Beit HaMikdash. Okay. So the Kli Yakar asks the question, if you go back in Tanakh and you read the story, for the first few hundred years in Israel, the Jews didn't have kings, they had shoftim. They had advisors, guiders, and all that, like Shmuel and other prophets, other great people, Shimshon and so on. And then they came to Shmuel to ask for a king, right? They came to ask for a king. And they said, we should have a king like all other nations and so on. Shmuel took it back to God. Shmuel was upset. God was upset. They had done the wrong thing to ask for a king, but because they asked for a king, so God said, okay, go and appoint King Saul. Says the Kli Yakar, what do you mean? It's in the Torah. It's a mitzvah to ask for a king. It's a mitzvah to appoint a king. So what was the problem? So very beautifully explains the following. You've got to look at the Hebrew phraseology in both instances. When it came to the king, the story by Shmuel, when they came to Shmuel and they asked for a king, in Hebrew, the phrase they used was, Tana lanu melech, give us a king. Right? In the Torah, when it talks about the mitzvah of appointing a king, it says, Asima alai melech. He says, when you come to Israel, you will say, place upon me a king. Very different. He says very different. He goes the whole beautiful thing. He actually talks about this a few times during the Chumash. I suspect that eventually became the chief rabbi of Prague, but I suspect that one of the places, he was a great tzaddik and a real sincere leader, and I suspect one of the places they gave him a really rough time. Because he often talks about this. And he said like this, he says, sometimes when they asked for a king in the Shmuel's time, they said, Tana lanu melech, give the king into our hands. Right? We the board of management, we want to appoint the king and control the king. Right? And we want to tell him what decisions he should make. So he'll be the figurehead, in other words, but the decisions that he'll make will come from us. Right? That's not a king. Hashem was upset. You want a king, appoint someone who you really believe is a true leader. Doesn't mean that leaders don't make mistakes. There are plenty of leaders in Tanakh that make mistakes. But if you're going to appoint leadership, you can't appoint leadership that you want to control. That's not leadership. And a leader can't be a leader if he's going to follow. It's not leadership. Leaders have to lead and have to make decisions which are unpopular and they have to have self-control. Obviously, when they say they have to make decisions that are unpopular, it doesn't mean they can make self-serving decisions. But you know, that's a problem with leadership sometimes. But very often, people make decisions based on the people that they're leading. They're following the people rather than leading them, right? And we find this so much now. Like, obviously, there's so many, even with the anti-Israel stuff that comes out now here in Australia, a lot of it has to do with votes. That's all it is, about the constituents, right? That's not leadership. Now, when we talk about, and by the way, this happens on all levels, right? We have a parenting crisis going on today in our world, which is that parents are not leaders. They are following their kids. They're scared to say no. They're bowing into the social pressure that kids have, and they're not making decisions, which they should do with love and respect and so on, but it still needs to be tough and firm decisions sometimes, which make the parents unpopular, maybe even make the kid unpopular for a time being. But it's teaching them values and it's shaping them as moral human beings, right? So that's one of the ideas as we begin the year. We eat the head of a fish and we ask, we should be a head and not a tail. We should learn how to lead. Now, why do we all say this? Because the truth is the same concept works within our own experience. So we've talked about this many times. We have the head, our own head, right? Which is the intellect, the power of cognition, which is the power of moral decision. It's the power of decision making. And then we have our impulses, which the head is supposed to lead. Right, the moach shalit al halev, like the phrase goes from the book of Tanya, the head must rule the heart, right? Which for a period of time, that was a very, very popular principle in modern psychology. Unfortunately, not really modern psychology, because they've now switched it back to the old way, but there was, and Viktor Frankl and Edith Eger and positive psychology, the idea was, and CBT and these things, that you have to use your brain to frame things and to understand what is moral. Stephen Covey always talks about the pause. When you have something that you impulsively want to respond to, you've got to pause and let your head lead. So your head can make a decision in the right way. It can choose between right and wrong and between good and bad and so on and so forth. And the head leads the rest of the human experience. But often we don't do that. Often we become followers. Our head becomes a follower. We use our intellect just to figure out how to get what our heart wants. Which is exactly the same model as the king who's a follower. Well, that's what the Jews wanted in the time of Shmuel. But the Torah says in Parashat Shoftim, it says, no, asima alai melech. It says, God, the right way to do is to say, I'm going to submit. I'm going to surrender to leadership. I'm going to follow true leadership. I'm going to go out of myself. I'm not objective. I'm biased. I know that what I'm thinking, that's why we have in Pirkei Avot, right? The same idea. Pirkei Avot, we have this concept where we say, asei l'charav. A person should make for themselves a mentor, a leader, someone they're going to that's not them, someone that's subjective, someone that can guide them and advise them, right? And they have to be willing to listen, even if it's hard. Which is the bracha that we say at Rosh Hashanah. If you look very carefully at the words of the tefillah when we eat the head is not, we should be a head and not a tail. It says, Nihiyeh l'rosh. We should be to the head. In other words, we should submit to the head. Right? We should let ourselves be led, and we should be leaders. So true leadership, and also the willingness to submit to that leadership. Okay. So that's the idea of the head. But, as I said before, the minhag of the fish head is not just about the head. Right? The minhag of the fish head is about eating fish. Right? So even if you're on a fish head, it's a really important thing to eat fish on Rosh Hashanah. That can be all fish, but it's normally sort of, the idea is kind of combined with a fish head, right? What's the idea? So I want to go into a few things, a few interesting things. First of all, if you look in the Siddur again, there's a tefillah they say related to fish, and that is, Shenifre v'nirbe kedagim. We ask God that we should multiply like fish. Now first we need to understand what that means. I think having children is a wonderful thing, and we should all try, and it's a good idea. But you know how fish multiply? It's kind of... I'm not sure everyone wishes for that, right? I looked it up. Did you know this? What's the most Jewish fish? Come on, us Africans. What's the most Jewish fish? Herring, of course. Okay. What's that? What was that? A king club, yeah. A controversial king club, right? So did you know that a single female lays like tens of thousands of eggs per year, about 20,000 to 30,000? Okay. But apparently, then I looked up about fish in general. Most fish are actually usually reproduced, right? Like, in fact, we know in the Torah that when God created the world, when human being was created, there was a blessing and a command given to the Jewish, given to the man and woman, Adam and Chava, Adam and Eve, pru uruvu, to bear fruit and be multiple, right? But there was a special one given to the fish. If you look in the Torah, it says pru uruvu, God blessed the fish to multiply. Was what?
We usually talk about multiplication in rabbits.
Rabbits, really? Oh, okay. No? But the idea, of course, is, I mean, obviously it's about multiplying. There should be more people and people should have children and those that can't should be blessed and so on. But it's also about a spiritual reproduction. In other words, we know that from Noah, right? If you look in the book, in the story of Noah, in the parasha, it deals with the story of Noah and his family with the flood and so on. It says there, these are the generations of Noah, which means... simply put, these are the children of the family of Noach. And the next thing the Pasuk says, it doesn't name his children, it says, Noach ish tzaddik. Noach was a righteous person. Later it comes back to his children. He had three children, Shem, Ham, and Yafet, and so on. So Rashi over there brings, and Rashi in the commentary, Rashi explains that the true generations of a person, there's two ideas of having children. There's physical children, which of course is a mitzvah, and that's how we survive, and that's how we thrive, and so on. But there's also a spiritual having children. There's a concept of having children spiritually. Right? Now that can be in many different forms. For example, when someone is a Torah teacher, so we learn in later on in the Torah, where it calls Aaron's sons, it calls it Moshe Rabbeinu's family, because he was the Torah teacher, and it says whoever teaches someone Torah, it says if he's given birth to him. But just on a general level, it means our good deeds. It says, Toldot shel tzadikim asim tovim. The children of tzadikim, of the righteous, are their good deeds. Their good deeds, their legacy, in other words, because every good deed that we do, every mitzvah that we do, is eternal. As we've spoken about a couple of weeks ago, and many times, that a good deed remains in the world. Bad things don't remain, they get washed away, they get cleansed, but good things remain. Everything we do, every mitzvah we do, every good thing we do, every kindness we do, every action that we do that is positive, there's an energy that is produced and it remains eternally, right? So that's one of the ideas of asking for the fish, shenifre v'nirbe kedagim, that we should be multiplied like fish. In other words, we should be able to do many, many good deeds. Last week we asked the question, how does it fit in with free choice? So we say, no, because we always need God's assistance. But once we have that blessing, then of course we've got to put in the effort to make the choices and try to do good deeds. Okay. Another very simple thing of eating fish is this. That fish is one of the symbols against the evil eye. Do you know that? Yeah. Ayin hara. Why is that? So we find in Jewish history, Yosef, Joseph was this concept of always being protected. So fish is like the idea of protection. And in fact, you know, we once gave a whole shiur recently on the evil eye, if you remember correctly. Oh, thank you. The fish, here we are. Talk about the fish. We once gave a whole shiur on evil eye, and there's various practices and segulot and things that people do to ward off the evil eye. Mainly, really, it's about living modestly and discreetly and not making a fuss of ourselves and things like that. But one of the things is sort of an amulet that people used to use, which was shaped like a fish. Why? Because fish is a protection for the ayin hara. Why is fish a protection for the ayin hara? Because first of all, it swims underwater. And that covering of the water resembles the concept of a protection. But more importantly and more interestingly is that the fish sleeps with its eyes open. Did you know that? Fish don't close their eyes. They right? And therefore, it's a symbol of shmirah, of always watching, of always protecting. That's also one of the reasons that we go for tashlich Rosh Hashanah, or during the 10 days of Shabbat, right? The idea of going to a body of water which has fish, not just. There's the concept of a body of water. There's also about going to a place that has fish. Same idea, because what we're asking Hashem on Rosh Hashanah is for protection, spiritual protection, physical protection, and that's one of the reasons that we eat the fish. Okay. However, the main idea behind fish is the following that I want to share with you. A very interesting idea. I'll tell you where the idea comes from. In 1994, when the Lubavitcher Rebbe passed away, they discovered two very thick binders of notes that the Rebbe had taken for himself. Some of those things were ideas, Torah ideas that he later spoke about. Many of the things he never spoke about. And it was an incredible revelation. Some of them have the most fascinating insights. He wrote very cryptically and very briefly. So there was a whole team of people that actually learned the ideas, learned the topics, explored the topics, and were able to decipher what he was talking about. And they published them with sort of notes attached to them, so it can explain. My father-in-law was one of the team, and I remember him working on it. Anyway, so one of the Rishimot, one of these manuscripts that he wrote, they later published them all, was around the Parsha of Kashrut, right? Where the Torah talks about the kosher fish and kosher animals, right? And one of the underlying concepts behind there was that the simanim, the signs that make an animal kosher or a fish kosher. For fish, yeah. We'll get the physicals in a minute. So there's a whole discussion, even halacha, that doesn't mean that the animal is, it's a halachic analysis, doesn't mean that the animal is kosher, it just happens to be that all kosher animals happen to have these signs, or is it the signs itself that make the animal kosher, right? And he took the view in this particular thesis that it's the signs that make the animal kosher. Why was that so important? Because everything that happens in the physical world happens in the spiritual world as well. And therefore, it's actually not only to do with the physical animal, it's got to do with our own animal, our own kashrut, our own kosherness within ourselves. So just very briefly, because I have shared this once before we get to the fish, right? When you have I'll come back to the fish in a minute, but when you have a kosher animal, we know the kosher animal has to chew the cud, and has to have what they call cloven hooves or split hooves, whatever it's called, right? What's the idea? And the idea is, in terms of our own personal growth and how we grow, in our lives and our relationships and our spiritual growth and so on, is that two things are necessary. First of all, chewing the cud is a symbol of reflection. What is chewing the cud physically? When you eat and then you eat it again, right? The idea spiritually, what that means is the idea of reflecting and reviewing. Right, so that's not very relevant now, like that in the month of Elul, that where we reflect back, we have to revisit things and think about them. In Judaism, we are told to pause and pay attention and think, is what we're doing good? Is are we doing enough? Or what are the strengths? What are the weaknesses? How can we fix it? So that's the idea of chewing the cud. The split hooves is an interesting one, is about having two separate categories, which is like chesed and gevurah. Like we said before, that real growth comes from not only going with what you are naturally disposed to, but also incorporating that part of a personality that's not your personality. So like in chesed and gevurah, we have chesed people, gevurah people. If you're a chesed person, you need to know sometimes you have to apply gevurah and vice versa. Okay. But I wanted to concentrate on the fish, which is the Rosh Hashanah one. So as you said, a kosher fish has fins and scales. Okay. So there's a fascinating Talmud. And the Talmud says like this. The Talmud says, if you're searching for a kosher fish, right? Let's say you're in a fish shop. Theoretically, I mean, it's good to know what fish are kosher, but and you see a piece of fish, but you don't see the fins because the fins are being cut off, right? But you see clearly that the fish has scales, right? Do you have to make sure that it also has fins? Says the Talmud, you actually don't. Because all fish that have scales also have fins. Just a fact, a reality. All fish that have scales have fins, right? However, says the Talmud, there are fish that have fins but don't have scales. So if you look at the fins, that's not a proof that the fish is kosher. However, if you see scales, it is a proof the fish is kosher, right? So what's the obvious question? So what do we need? How many signs do we need?
Just one.
Only one. So the obvious question is, why does the Torah talk about fins? The Torah clearly talks about fins, right? In other words, the Torah could have just said, in the Torah where it talks about the kosher fish, it could have just said, a fish that has scales is kosher. Even though what God really wanted was we should have fins also, but the fact is that any fish who has scales has fins, therefore just say, if it has scales, it's fine. And the Talmud says something very strange. Torah says, so Rabbi Avo, one of the rabbis of the Talmud says, that he quoted from a different rabbi, that the Torah mentioned the fins so that the Torah should be increased and made great. How does the mentioning of fins increase the greatness of the Torah? Or the greatness of applying the Torah? I mean, it's another word, that's all. It's an extra sentence, extra word actually. The Torah talks about snapir ve'kaskeset. Snapir is fins, kaskeset is fail. Okay, so that's one extra word. The one extra word is not what makes the Torah great. I mean, like, yeah. In fact, normally the Torah tries to shorten its words. It doesn't say extra words for nothing. Especially the written Torah I'm talking about, right? So, he explained the following, a very beautiful idea. There's two parts to the human experience when you talk about, in other words, like this, the signs of a kosher animal, that's just very basic. The idea of review and the idea of always being ready to do something that's not comfortable, that's not personality, that's the hooves, fine. Then there's something greater, the fish or something already a bit more holier. You're trying to really engage in something higher than yourself, something more holier. There are two things that are needed. So one is, any growth experience needs protection, guidance, discipline. And that's the scales, right? The scales essentially are like a coat of armor. It's a coat of protection around the fish, right? And this is incredibly important generally, right? Because we are so prone to make decisions sometimes. In other words, even though I said before that it's our brain that causes us or gives us the ability to make decisions between wrong or right, it's our brain that allows us to say yes to something, no to something else. But the brain can be very easily swayed, as we know, right? So in other words, sometimes a person can think that he's or she's making a decision based on thinking, and yet the thinking is distorted. Why? Because there's something deeper than cognition. There are things that live in the subconscious of the human being. And we've talked about this before, one of the things that lives in the subconscious of the human being is ego. And therefore ego doesn't mean only ego. It doesn't mean only terrible self-interest. It can be self-serving, right? I'll tell you an unbelievable thing, how careful a person has to be, right? And I think I've told you this before, but since it's a couple of weeks till Yom Kippur, right? I'll tell you this, an amazing thing. Just the Torah says, the Torah talks about, also we read this a few weeks ago, about not taking bribery. So first of all, there's fascinating stories of how like a judge can't take bribery, right? So there was a story in the Gemara about one of the Dayanim, one of the judges of the Talmud, who was so careful in this. That once he was walking into the Beit Din and he was going to officiate at a litigation, at a Din Torah, at a court case. And one of the litigants, one of the parties walked in. He walked in behind him and he saw he had some dirt on his jacket. So just out of courtesy, he said, you know, excuse me, I think you have some dirt. And he wiped it off. And the judge says, I have to recuse myself now. Because I can't trust myself that I'm going to be completely objective because you did me a favor before coming. Something so simple. But then there's a Gemara, there's a Talmud that's really fascinating. I got to share this with you, just to give you a bit of background, but it's an unbelievable thing. You know how in the Jewish calendar, right? In the Jewish calendar, we have something called a leap year. Leap year means an extra month of Adar, right? Okay. Now, nowadays, there's a 19-year cycle. It's very set exactly which years of the 19-year cycle is going to be a leap year. Fine. What's the purpose of the leap year? The purpose of the leap year is that Pesach in Israel should come out in the spring, right? Okay. But in olden times, when the calendar was made differently, it was made month by month basis, based on testimony that the new moon had been, all these things, right? They were done year, month by month, year by year. So when it used to come the month of Adar, there used to be a meeting, a committee of people that would convene, and they would decide whether we should add an extra month of Adar or not. And it had to do with a few different things about where the sun is up to, where the seasons are holding, and the different factors which the Gemara, the Talmud discusses. Two of the people that were not allowed to be on the committee was the king and the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. Now, the king was an interesting thing because having a leap year would be to his benefit. The king was in charge of the army and finding the resources, the financial resources to pay the soldiers, and they would pay them a yearly salary. So if you add a month, it's to the benefit of the treasury of the king because you're paying them for more time. You're paying them the same salary, but it's for more time. It's a yearly salary because then the year becomes longer. Okay, fine. Why couldn't the Kohen Gadol sit on the committee? Listen to this. So the Kohen Gadol couldn't come on the committee because there might be deep down subconsciously a bias. What's the bias? The bias had to... Now, you have to understand, Kohen Gadol, high priest, was supposed to be a very, very righteous person. And for the most part, they were. They were very, very great people who were specially chosen of all the Kohanim to be very holy and very spiritual. And they were the Kohen Gadol. They were the people who represented us on Yom Kippur. The Kohen Gadol was the person who went into the Holy of Holies on Yom Kippur, right? Okay. On Yom Kippur... Now, you have to know, the leap year discussion took place around 7 months or 6 months before Yom Kippur, correct? Adar. The Kohen Gadol on Yom Kippur, he would do the whole day's ritual services. He would represent the Jewish people, all the special sacrifices, the sprinkling of the blood, and the blowing of the shofar, and kindling the offering of the incense, and so on. Okay. One of the things that the Torah mandates the Kohen Gadol to do is he has to immerse in a mikveh on Yom Kippur. Yeah? And not only once, but on Yom Kippur, 5 times. There were 5 junctures during the day that he had to immerse in Yom Kippur. The Kohen Gadol, if he was a real tzaddik and had longevity and whatever, it was not so easy to go to the mikveh. You have to understand, it's not like today. Mikvahs today have heating systems. In those days, they didn't have heating systems. They were cold. Cold mikvahs. Okay, now it's become now fashionable to take ice baths or anything like that. But I'm talking about normal people now. Okay? No, I don't mean to insult anyone that does that, but anyway. So not one of the things I'm planning to engage in, for sure not. I'm not going to choose to make myself freezing in the morning. Okay, but I don't care how healthy it is. Anyway, it was cold. And the Kohen Gadol knew this, right? So now, making a leap year, different to the king, making a leap year would be slightly to the detriment of the Kohen Gadol. Why? It would push off Yom Kippur, which means it would be more deeply into the winter. We're talking about now the northern hemisphere. Right? So we worry that Kohen Gadol might... Priest. Sorry? Priest. Yeah, the Kohen Gadol, high priest.
Yeah.
He worried that maybe he'd be in favor of a leap year. Sorry, he would be in favor of not making a leap year, not adding an Adar, which would make it easier for him to warm up. We're warm on Yom Kippur, easier for him to go to the mikveh. Right? Now, we're talking about a Kohen Gadol who's a righteous person, a tzaddik. He might not even know this, but subconsciously, somewhere deep down, he might have a self-interest. That's how strong self-interest could be. We need to be aware of that. That's why to be a kosher fish, you need scales. That's what scales represent, protection. Especially because all the fish that have scales also have fins. What does fins represent? Fins represents a different story. Fins represent growth. But not just growth, because what the Talmud says that what a fish does, it swims with its fins, right? There's an expression in the Talmud that with one swoosh, because of the fins are so powerful, the fish can go from point A to point B very quickly. So what fins represent quantum leap of growth, spiritual growth, right? And growth is a fantastic thing, and growth is an important thing, right? But nevertheless, growth can also be dangerous. Because growth, if it's done influenced by one's own self-interest, ambition when it's fueled by ego, even if it's for the right things, like we have the story, I've said this a few weeks ago, we had the story of Korach, where they wanted good things, they wanted to bring incense, they wanted to do the right thing, but they were influenced by their own ego. They wanted to do something extremely holy, but it was disaster because it was for the wrong reasons. Because sometimes growth is something you shouldn't do, depends what it is. You should have big spiritual ambitions, but you also have to know when to do it and what to do it. Like Moshe Rabbeinu told the people of Korach, I also want to be a Kohen Gadol, but I can't, it's not my role. Right? So growth is very important, but yet growth can be disastrous if it's not done properly, if there's no protection. So therefore, in order for fins to be part of a kosher fish, there has to be scales. Right? Because scales is the protection. Scales is always asking, consulting, reflecting, talking to a friend, talking to a mentor, making sure that what you're about to do is really important, really good, and it's going to be beneficial. Therefore, says the Talmud the following. Every fish that has scales has fins. If you have scales, then fins is a very good thing. If you know how to protect yourself from your own ego, then growth will be fantastic. But if it just has fins and no scales, it's not a kosher fish. And you can have fins. There are fish that have fins, which means they're very ambitious, they want to grow, but they're not kosher. Why? Because they don't have the protection. Yeah? So then the Talmud asks the question, so then why did the Torah have to mention fins? It says to make the Torah great. What does that mean? Because if you only mention the scales and the important, and you highlight the importance of scales, then the opposite might happen. A person might be so protective of himself and not wanting to make a mistake or not wanting to do the wrong thing that the person will hold him or herself back from growing. The ambition will be diluted. So the Torah says, no, a kosher fish is scales and fins. The fins are important. The Torah mentions it to make the Torah great. What does it mean to make the Torah great? To let us engage in the spiritual journey much more than we had before. To learn how to grow. To learn how to take a risk. And if it doesn't work out, we backtrack and we do tshuva, whatever the case is. So we have to have fins. Don't undermine the importance of fins. Just understand that fins without scales is not kosher. And that's why, on one of the reasons maybe that on Rosh Hashanah night, we eat fish. We place emphasis on fish. Because as we, again, it's always, the symbols have two things to them, right? One is about the blessings that God is going to give us. So we eat fish because we want to multiply. We want to eat fish because we want God's protection from the evil eye and so on and so forth. But the symbols also teach us lessons. And the lesson of the fish is that we have to grow. And that's, it can't be a better lesson than on the first night of Rosh Hashanah, right? That's the, you're starting the year, you got to grow. But if you've got to grow, you need to know two things. First of all, you need protection. You need to consult. You need to ask. You need not to get your ego mixing into the journey of growth, because then it'll be a disaster. So you need protection. But don't think that because you need protection, that you need to hold yourself back from growth. You need to grow. You need to eat a fish that has both scales and fins, because that's the formula for growth. The combination of the both will produce healthy and effective and great growth. That's the symbolism behind the fish. So before we finish, just again, we're going to do another one next week. So I just want to remind you. That will be the last one before Rosh Hashanah. Also, we've got lots coming up now. Rosh Hashanah, the second day of Rosh Hashanah in Vaucluse. By the way, just to make it clear, I'm not... And anyway, the purpose of the Minyan of Rosh Hashanah in the second day of Vaucluse is not to take away anyone from any other shul where they're davening. It's for those who maybe were thinking of not going to shul second day, which happens. If you're not thinking, you're invited and encouraged. It's a shorter service. It's very explanatory. We explain with a bit of meditation. It's very meaningful. So come along and spread it to others. It'll be the home of the Spirides, Ariel and Avi Spirides. We have our Sukkos. I'm just mentioning it now, so you'll, when you get the WhatsApp, you'll be familiar. Our yearly Sukkos morning tea in my Sukkah in Anglesey Street. Also, we'll have it like every year. Which are the details? There's a thing we're doing for men one night of Sukkot as well. Also, the stuff we have, we're doing a lot of stuff for the younger generation, for young adults. So, if you know young adults, please, including this coming Tuesday night, we're going to have a beautiful event called New Year, New Life, which will be socializing, food, nice food, and then music and inspiration and kumzitz. So, if you know any, it'll take place at the Green Garden Hall next door at Mizrahi. So, please spread the word to the young adults. And see you next week. And we're down now to the last 12 days of prep. Today's a special day, by the way. It's the birthday of the Baal Shem Tov and the Alter Rebbe, your ancestor. So it's now the 12 last days of Elul to put in extra effort and a meaningful preparation for the coming up Rosh Hashanah. Okay, have a wonderful week.